Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lagunitas Brewing Company, challenging the status quo and crafting stories along the way. Featuring a wide range of innovative craft brews and non-alcoholic options, it's good to have friends. Learn more at Lagunitas.com.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My next guest is Steven Van Zandt. You might know him better as Little Stevie, the guitarist for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. Or maybe you know him as an actor. He starred in the Netflix show Lilyhammer, and he played Silvio on the legendary drama The Sopranos.
You're under arrest for violation Title 2C, Chapter 37, Section 2 of the New Jersey Penal Code, promoting gambling.
Here, go ahead. Last year I made bail so fast, my soup was still warm when I got home.
He can sing, he can act, he can play guitar. In other words, this is a guy who's led an interesting life. He recounts all of it in Unrequited Infatuations, a memoir. The months-long tours, recording sessions, international fame, the ups, the downs, the many, many, many headscarves. And of course, his solo music. Here's a song from his band, Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul, Tucson Train. Steven Van Zandt, welcome to Bullseye. I'm happy to have you on the show.
Good to be with you, my friend.
So I've been recording this show mostly remotely the last couple of years for obvious reasons. I get to like look through the video conference into people's offices and houses and places where they're recording. And I just want to start by acknowledging that you're basically recording in the perfect Little Stevie Van Zandt themed environment there.
purely by accident, I assure you.
Surrounded by tapestries and like 1959 jukebox.
Well, yeah, I guess now that you mention it. We usually are upstairs in the kitchen. But I'm very rarely down here. So I'm not sure what's behind me.
I'm grateful to have you. Grateful you took the time. Do you remember what the first rock record that you were obsessed with was?
It would have been one of several because I wore a couple of singles out, which wasn't easy to do in those days. It was either Sherry by the Four Seasons, Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers. Could have been Pretty Little Angel Eyes. You know, somewhere in there.
Were those songs that you heard on the radio?
Yeah, this would have been like 61, 62. You know, it would have been, we had, you know, the AM radio back then was great before, you know, long before FM. Yeah, it would. That's the only place you would have heard it would be on the radio. American Bandstand was on by then.
A couple of very nice automobiles will go to two lucky winners that you selected in the American Bandstand Dance Contest. Our special guests of the day are Underground Sunshine. It all happens here right after this word. Listen to the sound of this record. You can figure out why this group is the most talked about group of its day. Mr. Crosby, Mr. Stills, Mr. Nash.
Looking at the world through the sunset in your eyes.
What did your parents think of that music?
Well, that was the thing that was interesting. I talk about this in the book. You know, the invention of the portable record player really allowed for these things to take place without your parents' knowledge, which was essential, I would say. And as I said, without that portable record player, I'm pretty sure rock and roll would not have happened. Because you would have had, you know, the old record players, for those of us who are older, the record player was built into this piece of furniture in the living room, which also had the one TV and the one radio in the house. You know, and everybody had the same thing for some reason. And so the living room record player had to have your parents' approval. It was right in the middle of the house. You know, I don't think rock and roll would have even survived had that been, necessary. Fortunately for us up-and-coming, troublemaking teenagers, the portable record player was invented so we could play them to death in our own rooms.
Did you think immediately when you were young, like, this is what I want from my life?
No. No, not till the British invasion, at which point it was my life. It became my life. Up until then, I was just buying singles and disconnected really from it. I didn't even particularly associate the records with the artists that much. You know, I don't know. I was just kind of a slow, dumb kid, really. But
I don't know if that's it. I think when you're a kid. I have so many vivid feelings and memories about Jump for My Love by the Pointer Sisters. And it's because it passed through my life and was very important when I was 5 years old. You know what I mean? You know, The Freaks Come Out at Night by Houdini. This is the same place in my mind. And it wasn't about, I had no idea about, like, Houdini had great outfits and everything. I didn't even know about that.
Well, you had The Freaks Come Out at Night and I had Satisfaction. So what can I tell you, you know?
I mean, they're great records. That's the category we're talking about here.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, it was very lucky growing up when we did.
Well, the British invasion hit when you were like the perfect age to be transformed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you were like entering adolescence and like ready to be a new kind of person. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And feeling like I really didn't fit in with any of the options society was offering, you know? So that was the other factor. You know what I mean? I wasn't comfortable somewhere else and had to be moved to this new world that the British invasion was revealing, this world of bands, which was really what it was all about. You know, we never saw a band until the British invasion. You know, you went to your high school dance, it was instrumental groups. You didn't see four or five guys playing and singing. You just didn't see it. And so that entire culture would be changed February 9th, 1964.
I mean, what's wild to me about it as somebody who is a different age from you is it's hard for me to wrap my head around how fast the culture around rock music changed during a time when you were like a teenager. You know what I mean? Like you go from pre-British invasion through the British invasion. You know, it's hard for me to understand that the Beatles went from dorks doing corny R&B covers to like the like most important pop musicians of their generation to like the most progressive pop musicians of their generation in like 3 years or something.
Well, time,
you know, and then like hippies changed the world and then we're done 18 months later.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah. I mean? No, it was like that. Time was very, very different in the 60s. And you're absolutely right about that. It's hard to explain. We had a major trend that happened every year of the 60s. British Invasion 64, folk rock 65, you know, blues rock 66, psychedelic 67, country rock 68, southern rock 69, and then the great fragmentation in the 70s. But it was just like huge, huge changes and something remarkable happening every month or two. You know, here comes, you know, one band after the other, incredible, legendary bands. And then, you know, by the way, here's this kid, Jimi Hendrix, and here's this, you know, Procol Harum, and here's, Jefferson Airplane and the Doors and Stones and the Who and the Kinks and the Hollies, you know, and Dusty Springfield and Curtis Mayfield and, you know, and just Motown alone. You know, ridiculous roster of geniuses, you know, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and the Temptations, Four Tops, you know, one after the other, you know, Martin the Vandellas. And we just took it for granted that this extraordinary renaissance was never going to end. And of course, it couldn't last, and it didn't. And like I said, by 69, 70, the major trends, genre trends that would take over the entire culture and made us very much a monoculture for those years, fragmented into from singer-songwriters over here to heavy metal over there and everything in between, starting in 1970 or so. And we would never be that monoculture again. But huge changes were taking place very quickly.
We'll have even more with Steven Van Zandt soon. We haven't talked nearly enough about playing in a band with Bruce Springsteen, which is something he's done a fair bit of in his career, so we'll get into that after the break. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Steven Van Zandt. For decades, he has played guitar in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. He also had starring roles on shows like The Sopranos and Lillehammer. He has a new memoir out called Unrequited Infatuations. Let's get back into our conversation. I was trying to think of, like, what are the things that strike me as distinctive about what it is that you do? Like, what are the things that tie together the Asbury Jukes and the work you've done with Bruce Springsteen and your own stuff and the records that you've produced and so on and so forth, right? One of them is that thing that you talked about wanting to be in a band. And it's not just the form of the band, but like the vibe of bandness. Like a lot of your work is basically about being buddies. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
absolutely right.
Communicating the spirit of buddiness.
Yes.
The other is that, like, right as you were becoming a professional musician around 1970, you were in like a rock world that was not just fracturing into lots of kinds of rock music, although it was, you know, there was heavy rock was getting heavy and there was all other kinds of things happening, but also like rock was transitioning out of being dance party music. And you have always been committed to getting a party started. You know what I mean? In a way that you can't say about Led Zeppelin or whatever. Led Zeppelin, great band. I'm not putting down Led Zeppelin. I don't think Led Zeppelin needs me defending it. But like like all of your work has always involved a certain amount of like, let's all get down. Like, let's have a party.
Well, most of it, yeah. I think one way or the other, I am motivated to motivate you. It may be dancing. It may be voting. I think you're right. Most of it has some motivating factor, let's put it that way, which comes out of the origin of us being a dance band in the first place, which most of the great bands were from the 60s and early 70s. We kind of brought that back with Southside Johnny and the Adberry Juice, because by 73, 74, that trend had long ended. People had stopped dancing to rock and roll by 60, 68, 69. But we kind of brought that back because in the bar world, the bar band world, it never stopped. You know, the bar band world, you had to get people dancing. People still danced in bars. That's what the bar owners wanted, because you dance, you get thirsty, and you drink more, basically. So that was a prerequisite, a requirement in the bar world, which was kind of existing in its own little, you know, parallel universe. And that's where we really made our bones. We made our bones in that 74, 75 years in the Stone Pony in Asbury Park as a dance band, just like the Beatles were a dance band in Hamburg, and the Stones, in Richmond, and the Who, and the Kinks, and the Animals. All of those groups were dance bands in the beginning. And why does that matter? Well, now you transition into a concert band, but you still have that extra energy that you needed to pull people out of their chairs and make them dance. You know, that is an aggressive, part of your DNA. You never lose that. So that's why we and the ones I mentioned are some of the most exciting bands in the world, because you still have that motivation to pull you out of the chair and make you dance, you know, or at least get your blood moving, and with the hope that, you know, if your blood is moving, it'll get to your brain and make you think better, you know.
You had known Bruce Springsteen since you were a kid, a teenager, but you weren't in the first band that he played with after he got his record deal. You had sort of been, that idea had kind of been floated and rejected at the very beginning. When the E Street Band was formed, did the bunch of you like have a conversation, or did Springsteen tell you, like, this is why I want to do this thing this way, or this is why we want to do this thing this way?
No, I don't think there was much verbal discussion about what we were doing. My dog here. My dog's getting antsy.
A really excellent dog delivery just happened for our listeners at home.
No, there wasn't that sort of intellectual, strategizing going on. No, it was all very, very instinctive.
But I mean, you must have known something that you wanted, because in the intervening time, you had even quit the business for a little while. You know, it's not like Springsteen was making huge hits. He was still trying to figure out how to put over what he was doing. And like, so everybody had this time to kind of marinate on it. And it seems like there was a lot of mission involved. You know what I mean?
Subconsciously, perhaps, you know, instinctively, but not literally. We started to feel, as one could easily do today, like things were slipping away. Like important things were slipping away. That's what it felt like in the early 70s. Yes, everybody was obsessed with being modern and new, and you could tell, you started to feel, oh, the Renaissance was finite. It's not going to continue. It feels different now because of the fragmentation and because of the hybrids. We're not going to see that complete originality and ever again. And there was something about going to the source of that complete originality, as close as you can get to it, and taking your identity from that, that would make you stronger. You know? That's what we felt then, and I feel it now. You know, I mean, my stuff, it's never been timely, which makes it timeless. and so you listen to it, and it doesn't fit in anywhere. But there's an intrinsic quality to it that I would put up against anything, ever, because I made a point of that. You know, the greatness part of what we do is something that you make a decision about. And I'm chasing greatness all the time. I seek it out wherever I can. I support it when I find it. And I try and achieve it. Always. That's all I care about. And so that has its own currency. It may not be monetary, but it has a certain currency. It's why people, you know, always respect my work. You know, they may not buy it in big quantities, but I've always had that respect. And even live, same thing, live. And it's something that it's a fealty. You know, it's a certain respect and honor and loyalty to where we come from. And for some reason, that's our thing, you know, and it's all of our, it's our Jersey kind of thing, man, you know, and I've continued it on the radio show. You know, you hear it in my radio network. The stuff we play is the best music ever made, in my opinion, and that includes 1,000 new bands doing it today.
I was reading you describe a trip you took to Italy when you had some hit records in Italy, and these were your hit records, and you were like describing being recognized on the street, and which was, you know, for your albums that had your name on them, and feeling kind of odd about that, and like, maybe this is not what I wanted from my life. And I wonder if you thought that's what you wanted. Like, were you, you know, the consummate second in command in the E Street Band and in the Jukes and so on and so forth, because that's where you wanted to be? Or did you think you wanted to be somewhere else?
Yeah, no, I never wanted to be in front. I never had that desire. It happened kind of by accident and by me getting into politics, which I felt, you know, this is not really a band thing. I'm kind of taking a stand here on very controversial politics. You know, political situations, it's not really something you can tell a band to go down with the ship. You know, it gets, you know, my life threatened and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you kind of, you know, the solo thing became something I just felt I had to do at the time, but it was never something I wanted to do. Never. And I realized that when I happened to have those two hits on that one album. You know, we're doing our usual thing, walking down the street, and suddenly there's hundreds of kids attacking me, you know? And that's what you're supposed to like that. You know what I mean? You're supposed to say, oh, you know, I'm a success. This is what I wanted. And at that moment, I said, I don't like it. I don't like this. Okay? If this is what being a superstar is, I don't like it. I want to create greatness. I want to create great records and do great TV shows and whatever I'm going to do. But I don't need to be the star. You know, I know that's, you know, through the years you learn that you kind of have to be, you know, if you really want to have enough power to do what you need to do, a little bit of celebrity doesn't hurt, you know. But if it was up to me, I would just be the writer producer. I'm just fine with that. You know what I mean? I don't need to be the performer. I don't need to be the celebrity. I do not want to be mobbed by a bunch of kids when I'm trying to go have a cup of coffee.
I mean, it's funny because you are both, like, you couldn't be, you're obviously like the most consummate sideman or second in command. Like, there's no greater symbol in American popular music. With all due respect to Jerome from the Time, like, there's no There's no greater support piece than you in a band. But also, like, in so doing, you are also almost absurdly distinctive in doing that, right? Like, you have, like, I can see you right now. You are dressed as Stevie Van Zandt. You know what I mean? Like, there's no mistaking. So it's not like, so you're also the furthest thing from anonymous. You know what I mean? And it's kind of an interesting in-between place to be. Even in the Jukes, you know, like, sure, you're not the lead singer, but you're right there. You know what I mean? Like, you're not hiding in the wings.
No, you know, I know what you mean. And that just goes along. I guess this just goes with the territory of any kind of performance. You know, as soon as you step onto that stage, you're going to have some of that, you know. And you want some of that. You do. You know, you want to, you want people to like you and like what you do and appreciate what you do, you know. Again, it has its limits, you know, for me. I'd rather not be the guy in the spotlight all the time. I just don't want to live that way. I want to occasionally be able to observe and not be observed, you know. So you got to find your way to do that. I mean, that's one good thing about living in New York City. You can hide in plain sight, you know, pretty much. But I know what you mean. But that's, you know, some of that's okay. I mean, you know, you're gonna get some respect because you do good work, and that's, you know, you want that. You do want that.
We'll wrap up with Stephen Van Zandt after a quick break. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travell Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification? We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm talking with musician and actor Stephen Van Zandt. His new book is called Unrequited Infatuations, a memoir. Let's get back into our conversation. Did writing the book change the way that you thought about your life? I mean, you are in a way forced to reflect.
The one thing I must say that I feel a little bit better about, all my life I thought, well, could I have stayed in the E Street Band and still done what I did? You know, still done the 7 solo albums and the Sun City Project and Sopranos and Lilyhammer and, you know. And in my fantasies, I always thought, yeah, I could have found a way to do that. But when you go back and live it, you realize that's just ridiculous. There's no way that could have happened, you know. You know, you couldn't go to Bruce at the peak of Born in the USA or whatever and said, you know, by the way, Bruce, you know, would you mind? I'm going to take 6 months here and see if I can become an actor. It's not going to happen. I think I'm more at peace with the decision I made at the time, which very much seemed like the end of my life. And I think that's how the book can be useful for some people, because sometimes when you think your life is over, and I really did, you know, I wasn't changing jobs when I left the E Street Band. I was ending my life. There was no plan B after that. And, you know, everybody's going to hit that wall, I think, in their lives sooner or later. You're going to be disappointed. You're going to be, you know, depressed. You're going to, your job is not going to work out. Something's going to happen. It's, you feel like you're done. And if you can find a way to hang in there and just find some way to survive and move forward without being decimated by drugs or alcohol or suicide, all of which I considered, if you can find a way to get past that and move forward, destiny will surprise you. Everything I've done in my life, pretty much, that has value, happened after I thought my life was over. And I think that can be instructive, you know. I hopefully that can be inspirational to somebody who thinks their life is over. And then look what he did after his life was over. He did everything, you know, virtually everything that matters after it was over. So I think destiny can surprise you if you can find a way to, you know, just keep moving forward somehow.
And I mean, you got to join back up. You get to be in the E Street Band as long as you want now.
Yeah.
You guys will be 95 years old doing 3.5 hour concerts.
Yeah, we'll be 95 waiting for the COVID thing to end.
That's fair.
Waiting for the new variant to go away. Yeah.
So there's one other thing that I want to ask you that's pretty stupid, which is, somebody suggested this to me, and I was like, man, I really want to know the answer to that. So you are probably, the most famous image of you on stage is probably sharing a microphone with your friend Bruce Springsteen. The two of you yelling into the same microphone with your scarf flowing behind you, you know, and his gorgeous puss right up against yours. When you guys are doing that, are you spitting on each other? Like, is that a hazard doing that?
This is what keeps you up at night?
I don't know. Somebody said, are they spitting on each other when they do that? And I'm like, I kind of want to know whether they're spitting. It seems like they probably would be.
Let's see. We're losing 3,000 people a day to COVID. Russia's attacking the Ukraine. China's about to take over Taiwan. You know, we're about to lose our democracy in America. And that's what you're worried about? That's what you're thinking about?
You know
about?
What? One time I interviewed Larry King, and I asked him about his interviewing technique. I learned way more than I expected from interviewing Larry King. And the question that he said, that he gave as an example of a question he was really proud of, was asking a pilot when the plane took off if he knew it was going to land. And sometimes a dumb question is a good question. As soon as someone suggested to me, are they spitting on each other? I had to know the answer.
The answer is no.
Okay.
If you must know, absolutely not.
Well, Stevie Van Zandt, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. It was really nice to get to talk to you.
Hey, my pleasure, my friend.
Stevie Van Zandt, his new book is called Unrequited Infatuations, a memoir. Before we end things, let's go out on a tune from Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, one on which little Stevie played. We let Stacey Molsky, Maximum Fun's very own child of New Jersey, pick the tune. This is Rosalita. Little Steven on guitar and backup vocals.
Spread out now, Rosie, doctor, come cut loose her mama's reins. You know playing blind man's bluff is a little baby's game. You pick up little dynamite, I'm gonna pick up little gun.
That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun, in and around greater Los Angeles, California, where my 8-year-old Oscar took my power drill and disassembled the playhouse that was in the backyard. It's now a pile of sticks, and he also made a few swords out of it. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio, Valerie Moffitt, and Richard Roby. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation, recorded by the group The Go Team. Thanks to them and to their label Memphis Industries for sharing it. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us in all those places. Follow us. We'll share our interviews with you. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world, and that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way, stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.